Welcome to the Creative Curmudgeon. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am speaking with Clyde Peterson, who is an animator, a visual artist, a filmmaker, a musician who makes music under the moniker Your Heart Breaks. And is there anything else you would like me to mention at this time, Clyde?
I think that about covers it.
Fantastic. How are you today?
Thanks for having me. I'm good. You caught me in the middle of writing artist statements for my next art show, so I'm slowly putting myself to sleep. But it's coming along. It'll get there. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I've been having some anxiety today, but it's manageable. But back to you, I wanted to add a couple of questions about the thing you just said. Do you feel like sharing what the upcoming show is that you are writing an artist statement for?
For sure, yeah. I have a show at a gallery in Seattle. The gallery is called J. Reinhardt, and it'll be opening at the end of June and open through July. And the show is called Naive Melody, and it's a collection of screen-printed posters, essentially, with both lyrics from Your Heart Breaks songs and poems and prose and hand-drawn images. It's kind of a like abstract collection talking about both like searching for home and like how home can change throughout your lifetime and what it means to you. Also, like, looking at history and, like, the way home interacts with ideas of history and culture. So that's where my brain's been today. Yeah.
So some of it is from Your Heart Breaks, and then some of it is just kind of separate stuff you've been working on?
Yeah, it's all kind of related, because it all just comes out of me, but, like, some of it has text and some of it doesn't, is really, like, probably what I should say.
I see.
Yeah.
What is writing an artist statement like? I haven't written an artist statement. Well, I mean, like, when I've, like, submitted just, like, pieces of writing to places, you know, there has to be, like, some sort of third-person bullshit, and I never know what to say, and yeah. I just kind of compare it to what I've seen other people write and then think like, oh, I think this is what you're supposed to do. I don't know. What's that like for you?
Yeah, that sounds really relatable. For me, you know, I didn't really go to art school or anything like that. So I often look at other people's statements and consider how they feel when I read them. Mm-hmm. And, I try to keep it really simple and relatable, and I try to like use words that are not from like a higher education standpoint and more just like a emotional standpoint or a descriptions of like this is what this is, so try to relate to like everyone mm-hmm. who might be experiencing the art. And then I also have to like describe each piece of art, which then gets really into the weeds where I'm just like, oh my gosh, can't the art just speak for itself? But the answer is no. It feels complicated, you know, like pretty much the way you articulated it is how I feel.
Well, I mean, do you kind of have to, when you're writing something about a piece of art that you've made, do you already kind of have a manifesto that you thought out in advance that you can easily like, because for me, when I make something, I often don't know what I'm doing, and I'm just like making something, and then after the fact, I might be like, oh, that was about my dad, but I don't know at the time. So like, do you have to kind of like really think through after the fact, like, what was I even doing here?
I can relate to that too. I feel like I'm trying to just enjoy myself in this particular show. I really love screen printing, and I just am trying to make like visual art that is enjoyable in a strange way. And usually I work in a much like more conceptual level, but like this particular show, I wanted to just like explore and make art for art's sake. And so, yeah, after I've made it, I have to rewind and just like you're saying, and be like, what is this even about?
Right.
Sometimes I go into something knowing that it's like something I've been stewing on for a long time, and it's finally come together, and then I know what it's really about. But that's like rare, you know, you kind of those background things finally coming up.
Right. You currently live on an island. Am I understanding that correctly? In like the Washington area?
That is true. I do live on an island. I'm about 20 miles south of Canada, and I'm on a very small island, and I built an artist residency space out here starting in 2019, and I've just been running it and living next door. And I work at a screen printing shop and, you know, print t-shirts for my job and make art for fun. Yeah. Or I try to make money on art, but not always successful.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it easier for you to focus like where you are than in times where you lived in more of a proper city?
I ended up here kind of accidentally because I was living in Seattle for 10 years and my house got evicted in May of 2020. And I was like, I can't afford to live here. I can't afford to find a new apartment here. So I ended up moving to the island where I was building the residency space. And I live in a wooden boat in the forest with like no hot water. It's
I just want to
very.
interrupt and say, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to say, like, you started talking about Seattle being unin or not artist friendly as far as like, being able to afford it or whatnot. And I was thinking, like, I just heard this idea about Seattle specifically, and I was like, oh, God damn it, it's from Dylan Carlson from that movie that you made. So
Oh yeah.
that's where I
That's
heard that. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
yeah, no, you're good. You're good. Yeah, the rent in Seattle has increased exponentially over the past 10 years and just forced a lot of working class folks out and a lot of artists out of the city, so I just eventually gave up and gave in. Yeah.
Let's start it. Did you grow up in Washington first and foremost?
Sort of. I grew up in many places, but Seattle was one of them. I also grew up in San Diego and New York. So kind
Gotcha.
of, my parents were hippies in a Volkswagen van, so.
Right.
But I went to like elementary school and part of middle school in San Diego, and then I moved to Seattle for the rest of schooling.
Gotcha. What initially got you into being an artistic person?
Oh, let's see. That's a good question. My dad is very interested in art. He makes music and paints. He's an architect by trade, but my house was always full of like art projects, and I think just growing up in the Pacific Northwest at the time of DIY, like do it yourself, community momentum was a huge part of it. Like going to see bands at all ages spaces, having friends that played music and were in bands in high school, and then just eventually, you know, just being interested and curious. I feel like curiosity just drives most of my life in general, whether it's like making art or researching any number of things, yeah.
So there wasn't like really outside of like family, was there like anyone in particular Like for me, like an easy answer, and you probably have heard this a lot, especially growing up in Washington, was like first seeing Nirvana on MTV, and I was like immediately like, I'm gonna start playing the guitar.
Oh
And
yeah, I do have an answer just like that, for sure. Seeing the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special on MTV,
excellent.
like, oh my gosh, that just blew my mind. And the clay dinosaurs that live in the walls of Pee-wee's Playhouse, I just couldn't get enough of them. And I couldn't get enough of the animated talking fruit in the fridge. And like, I kind of identify as an animator by trade. Like, that's kind of where my heart lives. Like, I love animating things, but I don't get to do it all the time. And like, for sure, that like that answer like speaks to like seeing the Christmas special of Pee-wee's Playhouse. My uncle recorded it on VHS and gave it to me, and I was just like, that videotape is so worn down. I watched it a million times.
Yeah, I could see with because not only seeing animation, but seeing something that was really like eye-catching and different from any other animation you were seeing on TV at the time, that would make sense that that would strike
Yeah.
you.
Absolutely. And there's so much music in the show and so many colors and textures and patterns. It's just magical. Yeah.
When did you start making music?
I started playing guitar in high school, but I played flute in junior high and desperately wanted to play the drums, but my grandma would not let me. So she was like, "They're too loud. No,
Right.
you're playing the flute." And so, in high school, when I moved to Seattle and lived with my dad, he let me get some drums and played drums in orchestra, and then got a guitar and, learned about Nirvana, same as you.
There you go.
Yeah.
Did you start writing songs around the same time?
Yeah, I did start writing songs in high school. I had friends who were like much further along that track, and like I definitely did not value my own skill set at all, or feel like I was capable of that when comparing myself to my friends who like had bands and were opening for other bands, but I was very shy and quiet. I just loved to play guitar alone.
Is there a way that you I don't know if overcame it is the right word, but made peace with that shyness enough to perform in front of people?
Yeah, I think when I moved to Bellingham, Washington to go to college, I lived in a house with lots of other experimental artists who, it was just a space where like things could be experimental and not be judged in a particular way. And that was like an opening for so many artistic opportunities in my life, like making short films and playing music in the basement. We always had like music gear set up, so anyone could go down there and play music at any time, and so we always did. And eventually I met this person named Jamila who lived in Bellingham. She was from New York and had just moved out really randomly, and we started playing music together, and one of our housemates started playing music, and that was like the first kind of group version of Your Heart Breaks. And we like played one show at a DIY space, and then our second show was opening for Sleater-Kinney at the college. It's
Wow.
really wild, very intimidating.
And what time period was this?
98, it was like the Hot Rock
Holy crap.
tour.
Yeah.
Like Sleater-Kinney did a practice tour for the Hot Rock. They did some Northwest shows at universities, and we opened, and it was wild. And then I was like, oh, I guess we have a band now. We just start playing. It was like just the spirit of creativity in Bellingham at that time was gentle. It didn't have any commerce attached to it. It just was like, yeah, everybody's just playing. Like Ben Gibbard was doing experimental postal service shows and in basements, and Death Cab was just getting started, and everybody was just like having fun playing music. So it was a great way to come into that.
So you just kind of felt like less judged in that environment, so it kind of helped you thrive a little bit more and get out of your shell.
Yeah, the pressure was off, you could be weird. It was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as songwriting is concerned, like, do you usually write music and lyrics at the same time? Music first, lyrics first? Is it just all over the place?
usually get some lyrics going and then find a melody for them and then find the chords and then they'll start coming together. But yeah, usually words first.
What was I gonna say? Oh, the name Your Heart Breaks. Where does that come from? May I ask?
Yeah, I think that the short answer is before Your Heart Breaks, I was in a band with my sometimes bandmate Corey Brewer, and our band was called Fairy Tale Romance Makes Real Hearts Break, and it was based on like a book that Corey saw on like Oprah or something, and we just thought it was a funny band name, and we played a few shows as that band just for fun, and then I think it kind of just morphed into that, like a shortened version of that. So, yeah.
When you are working on, because I know you also have, additional things outside of music, just like you talking about working on your artist statement, and obviously you make movies and all of those things, and I would imagine that you are making music in between those things, just kind of like writing songs when you can and whatnot, but I was kind of curious how you divided up your time. Like, do you usually write more songs when you're not working on other kinds of art, or is it just kind of like whatever you feel like doing in the moment, that's what you work on? How does that work?
It's a good question. I work, so my time is kind of dominated. I work 5 nights a week screen printing at the shop, and so that's kind of like my nights are that. And then in the daytime, I usually have a lot of pretty free because I work like 8 p.m. till 2 a.m. So I have most of the day open. So I usually wake up and I go out to my tiny art studio and I play the piano for a little while. I have like a tiny piano and just start my day that way with a cup of coffee and just doing whatever, like learning a cover or having fun. No pressure. And then I'll get into like honestly whatever's like required of me for whatever I have coming up. So if it's some live shows, then I'll be like, "Oh, I better start practicing for these shows," or if it's an art show, I better make the art, or it's mostly like unfortunately, being working class, like my art practice is still dominated by like having to earn income. So I don't get to like sit around and daydream too often. I have some shows coming up this summer, so I'll start practicing for those and have this art show and I gotta make it. So it's kind of my process in general. Trying to get grants to make films, but
Are you going back
fail.
on tour this summer?
Not that I know of, but I'm playing a couple of festivals with Kimmy Dawson.
Okay.
And yeah, we did a tour with Kimmy last October down the coast from Seattle to Texas and back, and we're kind of easing back into that, but slowly for sure.
Gotcha. So basically, you start off your day as like creative stretch, if you will, just kind of like, messing around a little bit, and then just kind of get to the list in order of whatever is expected of you, whatever obligations you've got to do.
Yeah, I generally call it like seeing what's on fire. So I'll
Right.
like open the email and I'm like, what is this? All right, I guess I'm doing that right now.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to shift and talk a little bit about filmmaking. I want to start with Torrey Pines, which anybody who hasn't watched it should. It's excellent. It's on Vimeo. And I wanted to, because I don't know anything about animation. I've never tried to animate anything. And so I hope that I don't come across as ignorant o here. But I wanted to kind of talk about the process of it, like the stop motion animation process. It seems like it takes a little bit of time. And I was curious, like, first of all, did you draw everything yourself, or was it like a team? Like, how did that work?
Yeah, for sure. It does take a lot of time. It took 3 years to make Torrey Pines. I made it in my bedroom. We had a team of 7 people, 6 interns. Each person worked one day a week, and one hired employee who worked like 4 to 5 days a week, and then myself. And the other employee was also an animator. So everything in Torrey Pines is cut paper animation. There's jointed string puppets, which are made by hand, and yeah, everything is handmade and hand painted, and we had like a few style guides essentially for the film. Like one of the style guides was like, we hand paint everything, so we start with white paper no matter what, so that everything is like watercolored. And generally speaking, each intern was like, I don't know, they kind of each had their own special skills, and we would just put them on those skills. So someone was really good at making like foliage and like trees and plants and nature. So that person made like a significant portion of the set pieces for the film, which I loved. One person was from Arizona, and there's part of the movie that where the family drives through Arizona, and I was like, can you make, specialized things that you remember from your childhood in Arizona, like a UFO motel or like,
Oh yeah.
billboards and stuff like that. I tried to, like highlight people's skill sets and give them an opportunity to shine in a particular way. Like that's my favorite way to work with someone, is to like collaborate in general. Be like, what do you know? Like, show me what you know? So yeah.
Well, how did
Yeah, from
you
there, yeah, go for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was gonna say, how did you get these people, like, but
Oh yeah.
starting way earlier than this, you think to yourself, I want to make a movie. It's a stop motion animation movie. And then what happens?
Oh gosh, yeah. I was working at a job as a technical director at a filmmaking place, and I was like, I think I'm ready to make my first feature film. I had actually watched this truly fascinating film that was called Persistence of Vision. I don't know if you watched that, but it's a documentary about this animator named Richard Williams, and he's like a master animator, and he animated this stuff for like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and he developed a lot of amazing animation techniques. The story goes with him that he was making his like masterpiece film, and that he just couldn't get it done. He didn't have enough funding throughout the years. It was like this eternal struggle. And this documentary follows him as he's trying to make this film. And in the end, he fails. Like, he fails to make the film. Disney takes over his studio. They take the pieces of his film and they turn it into a musical. It's a nightmare. I watched that film with a bunch of other animators, and then afterwards, one of them was like, would any of you guys ever consider making a feature? And I was like, I think I would. Like, and it was just like that moment where, like, I watched someone who was like supposed to be the greatest, like, fail. And I was like, well, if he can fail, I surely can fail. And like, who cares? Like, he's still alive, he's still working. I'm sure it like broke his heart, but like, in that moment, I was like, oh, I'm not really like scared to try. So the reality of that was like, Kickstarter was kind of new on the scene. I kickstarted $40,000. It was wild. It was hard. It was challenging. It took a month of my life and probably 2 years of my life in real, in my out of my body. And then I was able to quit my job for a year, and I hired Chris Looney, the other animator. He had just graduated from digital animation college, and he was like, I never want to animate anything digitally ever again. And he was like,
Well, that
I
works
want to
out.
play with cut paper, and he was extremely skilled at cut paper. And we started building. I storyboarded the film and we started building, and then I put a little note on Facebook like, hey, does anyone want to be a film intern? And then I got a bunch of responses, and so we started having interns one day a week for 3 years.
So how much of it, let's say like 5 seconds of the movie. How long did it take to like draw out and move around like 5 seconds of it, for example, on average?
Sure. On any given day, we would shoot between 2 and 10 seconds of film. So, I mean, on a great day, walking away with 10 seconds of footage is like amazing. But usually, probably like in a day, we'd get 4 or 5 seconds. Yeah.
Wow. And then like what kind of and I don't I it, I'm, I was going to ask you what kind of cameras you use. Keep in mind I'm not going to know, like
Yeah.
you're going to say something and I'm not going to like immediately understand it, but
That's
the
okay.
yeah.
I'll say it in a way that you can understand it. I use just a very generic Canon DSLR camera. It's just like the one that many people use from the camera store that comes in a kit and it costs about $700 and you can get different lenses for it. It hooks up to a computer program called DragonFrame, which is an amazing animation program. And that program, it talks to your camera, and on the computer screen, you can see the live feed from your camera. And then when you take a picture using the computer as the controller, you see the last photo you took and the live feed of the camera, and you can move your puppet and you can see like the motion. And so it's a very magical like program, and it's built and made by animators, so it's really a great program. So that's how I shot it. It's digital in a computer through a DSLR. Yeah.
How did you teach yourself how to do these kind of things to begin with, since you mentioned you didn't go to art school?
Yeah, I had an amazing group of animators in Seattle. We had a group called Seattle Experimental Animation Team, SEAT for short. And I was working at a post-production house that was mostly making like ads for Benbridge Jewelers and stuff. And I was like miserably checking the mall addresses for each 100 ads for the jewelry company to make sure that the mall address was right. Like, and I was getting coffee for clients and answering the phone. And I just was like pretty miserable, to be honest. And next door, my friend Britta Johnson, who is an amazing animator, would be working at this production house doing animation pieces for commercials. And we would both be working late, and suddenly I would like smell smoke or something, and I'd be like, "Are you okay? It smells like fire." And she would be like, "I'm fine. I'm just animating fire." And I'd be like, "That sounds fun. What are you doing?" You know, and slowly I just would start drifting over there at night and just seeing what she was doing, and she was super generous, and I started like assisting her, and we did a bunch of animated things, and I just learned by watching Britta and working for her on many strange ads. And everyone in the Seattle animation scene at that time was just deeply supportive of each other. We had an email list, and you could ask questions, and everybody was just like learning and growing up together again, kind of like Bellingham, but in this space where just all wanted to support each other. I love that about Seattle. The scene is small and people kind of care about each other. It's nice. Yeah.
You wouldn't think of it as small, but that's interesting to hear.
I mean, the city's huge, but the artist community is small, so.
Right. I guess I'm just thinking like everyone always thinks of like grunge specifically as like, oh, Seattle is this, I don't know. I was born in 1984, so I think I'm always like just in that 90s brain.
Yeah, for sure.
Was it always easy for you to? It's very hard for me, for instance, to commit to any sort of like large project because, if I'll try to like work on something and then after a week, I'll be like, this fucking sucks. And then it'll go aside. So I have a lot of unfinished things. And as far as like working on movies, it seems like the ultimate the time sucker. And also, like, you have to have the most confidence in yourself because there's so many resources and so much time. Was that something that is easy for you? Did you kind of have to like work up to like making those kind of commitments?
I really grew up making music videos for bands, and so that was a really good way to practice making short films. And then once I made Torrey Pines, I was like, oh no, I'm addicted to feature filmmaking. And I love like the long format. I love a 10-year project. So I'm kind of the opposite of you. Like, I have very little interest in short-term things. And I really love getting into the slow snail pace of tiny incremental things adding up. And it's very contrary to like capitalism, unfortunately. But I love it. I love just getting lost in something that has a long story arc, whether it's like a novel or a long film or the production of a long piece.
So
I
you
hate being rushed.
you don't like ever think like, man, this is taking so fucking long, and instead like you enjoy like the meditative aspect of it.
I think I have both experiences, and the way that it manifests in man, this is taking so long is like in again capitalism and like not having funding or like having to pause my dream to like do a job and fundraise money to get back to my dream. So, yeah, that part is tedious, but I love going slow. It feels good.
I speaking of slow, I wanted to move on to Earth and
For sure, yeah.
Even Hell Has Its Heroes, the documentary that you recently made, which is excellent. Anybody can't that is listening that can see it should. It is about the band Earth and Dylan Carlson, and I was definitely going into it thinking that, I mean, I knew it wouldn't be a by the book music documentary because it's like not about a by the book band. So obviously like the qualities of a by the book music documentary, Henry Rollins is there somewhere for starters, and then like it just goes back and forth between seeing people like looking slightly off away from the camera talking, or lately talking into the camera has become like the new like in vogue thing with documentaries, I've noticed. But then the very linear trajectory of the start and then the ascent and then the descent and then the sort of ascent again and then it's over.
That's a really good description of a film. Yeah.
Whereas this is not that experience at all. Just to kind of describe it to listeners, if it's okay with you,
Yeah.
it's much more of a mood piece, if you will, very much matching the music of Earth itself. And a lot of it's shot all on Super 8, and there's a lot of just shots of lots of things that aren't seemingly band related, mixed with talking with different people who have been involved in Earth, and then some live footage as well. But it's very much not for my interpretation was that it was very much like not based on like the beginning to end story of it so much as just like the feel of the band in like visual form is kind of is I'm assuming that's kind of was that something you were going for, or like what did you how do you see
Yeah,
it?
that's a great interpretation. It's one of the best ones I've heard, for sure. Someone recently told me it was a drone film, and I was like, drone film. That sounds right.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I came away from the project feeling like this is a time capsule. It's a specific time capsule and a specific understanding of a group of people from the Northwest. And I like it that way, and I like a drone film, and I like an abstract documentary. I like them all the descriptions. Yeah, I feel like I was trying to let the band speak for themselves. Step away, step back, press record, and let them talk. And just that was the whole point. Just be like, hey, you have not gotten to say your piece. How about you say it right now, and I'll record it, and we'll put it together, and let's see what comes out. So it was fun in that way.
How did you go about, because like I just said, there's, well, first of all, it was that all I know that there was some stuff that was on tour. I even recognized some Phoenix stuff
Oh
from
yeah.
I was at that Earth show at the Rebel
Amazing.
Lounge, and know that Julio Berto is very well across the street. So I was very tickled to see those things like in that movie. But by and large, I'm assuming it was filmed in Washington.
Yeah, let's see. I went on two or three tours with Earth for the film. Before that, I was their manager for 5 years and toured with them a little bit, but we did a West Coast and then a Phoenix to Texas run, and yeah, that Phoenix show was fun to film. And then the rest was primarily filmed in Washington and a little bit in Oregon. I was trying to highlight like these spaces that are strange in Washington State that won't always be around, but each scene was specifically chosen to be paired with an Earth Band member, for like specific reasons, like the scene where Steve Moore, the keyboard and trombone player, is playing at a in Washington State on the Columbia River. There is a fake Stonehenge memorial. It's a war memorial, strangely, but it is a miniature Stonehenge, of sorts, and it's mathematical and beautiful, and these giant stones. And Steve is he's a musician, and he has a deep understanding of like the math of music. And I was like, this is the perfect place for Steve to play. So we picked him up at like 3 a.m. at the end of a first aid kit tour in Portland, and we drove him along the Columbia River and made him play trombone at sunrise, and he was so exhausted and such a good sport about it. But those were the kind of adventures that we had when we were making the film. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that sort of answers one of the questions that I was going to ask, because I was definitely wondering when you, because for me, when I'm making stuff, oftentimes it's like a something over here and then something over there, and then like I try to kind of like combine stuff later as it like may make sense. And I was kind of curious if you filmed all of this footage and then kind of put together puzzle pieces or rearrange puzzle pieces after the fact, as far as like this shot of this tree would be good here or whatnot, as it matches this part of the story. Or I was just really curious how you pieced all of that together.
I grew up before I went to college, and I took a class in filmmaking, and it was before digital editing. And so I was trained in a particular manner with three VCRs. It's called AB roll editing. And you very specifically piece things together by copying them off two VHS tapes onto a third VHS tape, which was the style of the time. And in that education, I was very much taught to shoot in camera and often would shoot in order in camera. So I find that a lot of the footage that I get back is often already in order, and it just takes a little bit of massaging depending on the timing of music. But generally speaking, that's how I work. Some of the stuff, like the in-betweens, when it's not a specific person in the film, those are more like pulling tree shots, or as you're saying. Yeah.
Right. That makes sense. How long did this take you to
Yeah.
make?
5 years,
Wow.
5 long years. I thought it would take two. I thought it would be faster than animating. It was not. And I shot it on film And I paid for it myself with my credit card, and I did like 4,000 jobs. I did every job that anyone offered me, and
Wow.
it was so hard. I found myself like animating dancing bananas and like just the most ridiculous jobs ever. I was just working all the time while making the film on the weekends. So,
Let's talk more about these dancing bananas. What was that?
was for a educational piece about arts education in Washington State and how you can incorporate arts education in your classroom. And you might want to consider dancing bananas. They were dancing with an apple. It was a whole thing.
Was it like the just how fruit is, or how apples anyway, are kind of like just incorporated into like school, like classrooms, or like I'm still unclear as to why the bananas were there.
I don't even remember why, to be honest, but it really sticks out in my mind as a moment in my life.
I mean, yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah,
Is
I
there
can't remember why there were dancing bananas in this piece about arts education.
is this available on YouTube or anything?
It is. Yeah, we could revisit it. It's definitely Artois. Gosh, what was it called? I can't remember.
Feel like
Out of
Artois
memory.
dancing bananas might get us what we're looking for.
Yeah,
Maybe.
creative something, right? The creative advantage, Artois. You'll
Okay.
get there.
All right. All right, everybody, look that up.
Clyde Peterson, creative advantage, Artois. You'll
Right.
get it. Yeah.
What are you working on other than your upcoming art show? Is what are you what and the shows that you are preparing musically for the summer? Is there I believe you're working on a film. Are you still working on a film?
Yeah, desperately trying to return to working on my next feature. And someday I'll get there. But right now, my life is totally taken over by this art show and my night job and working on a good level of exhaustion, I'd say. Running out of steam often.
No, I hear you. What
Yeah.
what is the movie going to be about?
Oh, the movie's called Our Forbidden Country. I have 10 minutes of it animated. It takes place in Seattle in like 1979, and it's based on like historic stories from interviews I did with older gay men about the downtown core of Seattle and how it used to be this incredible place full of like pornographic picture houses and strip clubs and sex workers, and just like Seattle itself was like a filth port for sailors. And it's been fully revamped downtown, and now it's kind of a hollow core of Nordstrom's and Macy's. But there's this underlayer to Seattle pre-grunge that is really fascinating to me, and I'm trying to make a movie about it.
That sounds awesome. And this is going to be animated as well, you said?
Yeah, it's stop motion. It's like Torrey Pines, but a little bit different style. Yeah.
Cool, awesome.
Yeah.
My last question was about Star Trek.
Ugh, yes, let's do this.
So I put together I actually saw yours and Kimya's show when you were in Phoenix, and
Oh.
my partner and I are massive Trekkies. And so your Wesley song, your Wesley Crusher song, we both, our ears perked at that. And then watching Torrey Pines, I there that's full of Star Trek references as well.
Yeah.
And I was curious how Star Trek specifically has influenced you as an artist.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's probably just my whole life. One of the prints from my new art show is like a design for my tombstone, and it's like the Enterprise on top of a gravestone, and it says TNG is the best Trek. And that's like the engraving for my tombstone. And I'm like dead serious about it. I'm like, this is it. Make it happen.
I want to return to that thought, by the way, but like let's keep this going.
Star Trek in my childhood was a place of dreaming and safety and wanting so desperately to be friends with Wesley Crusher and be on the Enterprise and be out of my household, and just be out there drifting. And throughout my life, it has accompanied me and been a source of comfort. I kind of slept poorly last night and I couldn't sleep. I threw on a little TNG and put me right to bed. Just watching the Burzan wormhole episode, the Ferengi decide not to get sucked through anyway. I feel really emotionally moved by season two of Picard. It like makes me weep. So, just on a personal level, because like I grew up with my mom who was schizophrenic and we watched Star Trek together, and that storyline for season two of Picard just really, it breaks my heart. Like when you like learn that Picard comes from this household where his mom is having mental health struggles and he's like blaming himself for it. And oh my God. Just, I mean, I really was like deeply disgruntled when I learned that like Q would be such a big part of that season. I was like, oh no, I hate Q, he's so annoying. But then in that season, I was like, holy shit, like Q is burning down this house. He is like asking Picard these really important questions about like, you're out there saving the whole galaxy, but like, are you gonna save yourself? Like, isn't the measure of one man and the worth of one man as equally important as like the galaxy? And I was just like dagger to the heart. So,
Yeah, it was cool for
I
that bit,
did.
like bring back that character and then like have it be, but like less zany.
Oh my God,
He played it
incredible
extremely well.
performance.
Yeah.
That's how Star Trek has been part of my life and continues to be.
So why is I love TNG. DS9 is my
Yes.
favorite.
Oh, cool. I love DS9 too.
Why is TNG your favorite?
I think it's just a childhood affiliation with it, but I do love like a Jake Sisko episode. Like that would be probably my second favorite situation is Jake and Nog off on some teenage deep space adventure. TNG, like I guess I like the idea. I love shows where people quietly discuss problems and try to talk work them out through talking. I feel like it's the least wartime series, and I enjoy that. And I like how like later they come back and they're like, yeah, the Federation like wasn't all that. We made some fucking mistakes during the TNG years, and I appreciate that too, but I love them all. I just really love all of them. Even Enterprise.
Enterprise, I really like Bakula in that, and I think Trip is great. Like I feel like,
Oh yeah,
obviously
Trip, yes.
the show is like the lowest quality of like that run of Star Trek shows, like obviously, but I think it has its I think it has its merit. I mean, like Archer is a douche, but it's like largely funny. So I
Yeah,
mean
he's
it's
just out there clowning in the universe, he's trying his best.
Right, yeah, it's kind of like The Office in space, where like T'Pol is like the person that's like trying to actually keep this together, and then Archer is just like this doofus that's just like wants to just chill. What was your opinion of the
Love
newer
that.
ones? I know you just said you liked season two of Picard. Do you like the newer batch of Star Trek shows?
Definitely, yeah. I'm up to date on Discovery. Strange New Worlds, big fan. I like them all. I like everywhere that they take me, and I like all these new characters. Oh my God, I'm just grateful for Star Trek. Like, I know there are a lot of people who just are very strongly opinionated about it. They like to complain about it, and I just kind of don't have any bandwidth for that. I'm just like, are you kidding? We get to be alive during this incredible wealth of Star Trek. Like, I'm so lucky.
N none of my students listen to me because I always preach about Star Trek, and I even wear my Star Trek uniform on First Contact Day. to school, and then like, you know, that'll be like, you know, kind of an icebreaker to start talking about Star Trek. But everybody, all of my students are obsessed with Star Wars, and it's very hard to, because I feel like Star Wars is like that instant candy sort of, you know, like you start off the first or the episode 4 of Star Wars, and it's like automatically there's a battle, and then Darth Vader shows up, and there's just like shit going on. Whereas like when I try to recommend Star Trek to people, it's like, all right, so Deep Space Nine, but like the first 2 seasons are pretty good, but then like, you know, once you get to season 3 and especially season 4 when Worf gets there, that's when it really gets cooking. Like, nobody's going to listen to me. Like, nobody's going to like put in that time, because I feel like it isn't that instant sort of, even the movies, like the Shatner movies, like there isn't that same instant gratification as far as much as Star Wars is concerned. So that's my struggle.
Absolutely. I was just describing this struggle to someone who's not really familiar with either, and they were like, what's the difference? And I was like, I think Star Wars is a very black and white show, and Star Trek is very shades of gray. So like, and Star Wars deeply rooted in war, or it's in the title. Star Trek, they're trying to live in a peaceful kingdom. They're trying so hard. They're goofing all over space, but I like that.
Right. Yeah. They're actually like you said, they're actually just like, even if you just like watch an episode of Next Generation, which, you know, are largely standalone. If you got somebody to watch an episode of that, like it's 90% people talking.
Yeah, I love it.
I do too. But yeah, that's not what a lot of people want from their sci-fi shows. They want like explosions and whatnot, and I think that's too bad.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you don't want to share before we conclude this?
I think that's it. I mean, you covered everything I care about, which is Star Trek. So thanks for that.
No, thank you. No, I was very excited to talk with you about Star Trek. Thank you for talking with me. Hello, listener. You are currently being hypnotized. You will donate to this podcast at venmo.com/thecreativecurmudgeon. Thank you for your time. So long.